Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We really appreciate you taking time today to join us for another edition of Midrats. And if you are with the esteemed cohort that is joining us live, if you'd like to scroll down to the bottom of the page, that's where you'll find the chat room. That's the perfect place if you have some thoughts you'd want to share during the course of the show, or if there are some questions that you would like for us to address over the course of the next hour, that's the perfect place to put it, and we'll be glad to grab your ideas and fold it into the conversation as we go forward. And if you have to take off and take care of business, you can always get the full archive of the show that you might have missed by taking an opportunity to go over to iTunes or Spreaker or whatever podcast aggregator you use, and you can subscribe to the free podcast there at that location. And we'll be waiting for you at time that might be more convenient for you. But today we're going to just jump right into the show. Now, the pre-show advertisements, we said we were going to talk about Russia and the China interaction, and we have a scheduled guest today that, unfortunately, we've been seen to having some challenges getting in touch with him. And we've left an invitation for him to go ahead and call the show live if you would like. If not, that's okay. We've got more than enough to go on for the full hour. And if he does call in, I'll be happy to introduce him. We'll go on from there. So you're stuck with me. You're stuck with Eagle One, and in the chat room, we've got Steven and Mr. Cowell joining us as usual. So we're going to start the conversation where we advertise, because there is a connection here that I think is really interesting. And we're going to talk about the war in Ukraine, or the Russia-Ukraine war, the second Russia-Ukraine war. I don't know if the intelligentsia have decided what we're calling it, but everybody was focused rightfully on China, and China is not sitting by and not doing anything either directly or indirectly because of what's happening there in the globe economically and just what she's seeing. So Eagle One, good afternoon. I guess you and I are going to have to carry the load for the next hour.
Hey, Sal. Well, I hope Dean calls in, or maybe we should try another call to him when we're on the air. Anyway, thank you. I'm glad to be back. I had a few days off, so.
Canned, rested, and ready. Well, we missed you last week, but it was, as usual, when you have Sal Marcagliano and Chris Cavas on, you can ease up an hour's worth of chatting pretty easily. And there's so much going on in the world, but all the oxygen in the room is being sucked out by the China and Ukraine. And when I was doing the show prep, looking forward to having Dean Chang come join us today, when he was talking briefly in one of his recent bits of work about the history, and those who are familiar with Chinese history know starvation and mass starvation is something that's embedded deeply in their minds. And back in December and January, and I would encourage people to do it if they haven't. Go to your favorite search engine and look up China grain hoarding, and you'll see lots of articles from like December and January that really tell some interesting numbers. That the USDA, when they did their 2022 estimates, one thing they mentioned, and I stole this off of one of the articles that was written in December of 21, that they estimated the U.S. Department of Agriculture that through 2022, China would hold 69% of the world's corn reserves, 60% of the world's rice reserves and 51% of the wheat reserves, because they have filled all their granaries, they've hoarded it, they put it everywhere but in the kitchen. And they said just because of whatever reason, people had no idea back in December, China was doing this, they were looking at global food prices increasing, especially in stressed and developing parts of the world, by 20% in 2022. And, you know, it came to mind, what did China know and when did they know it? That looks a little bit suspicious if China knew what was going to happen. Mark, you there?
Yeah, the concern I had about this was that initially when I saw some of these numbers was that China was hoarding this grain in anticipation of a blockade or embargo should they move against Taiwan. And I think the Chinese official in charge of all this stuff says they have about a year and a half supply of grain stored up already. And as the USDA has indicated, that they're going to get even bigger by the sometime middle of this year, I think, if they go on the way that they're going. So I would, you know, I'd be concerned that they're just getting ready to do that cross-strait invasion everybody's worried about. On the other hand, your point is well taken, that did they know that the breadbasket Russia and certainly the breadbasket of a lot of the world was going to be assaulted this way, and they were just anticipating that. So I don't know. It's kind of an interesting, you know, which can they both be true?
Very well. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, Dean brought up in his article is that for some reason, and I'd be really interested to know, though I have my suspicions, what school of thought in the foreign policy establishment thought that, you know, it was in China's self-interest to help us with Russia, where in the course of the last year, China and Russia's economic relationship, you know, for Russia, China is their number one export customer, and likewise, they're number one import country. So what interest would they have, the Chinese, in partnering with their geostrategic competitor, the United States, against really their one of their few friends in the world, and something we can talk about later on. It's that little alliance. I kept wanting to say axis, but we've already had an axis in the last century. We shouldn't use that word too much. But you know, that what's come out, that the Biden administration was talking to China throughout 2020, trying to get them to help us out. Obviously, that didn't work.
Yeah, that's you know, I see that China now is offering itself as a peacemaker with Ukraine and getting these parties to sit down. The other side of this Ukraine thing is that China's and Russia have this railroad system, part of the Belt and Road stuff that China's been developing, that leads into Europe. And this conflict really is rendering, I think China's worried about whether their Belt and Road stuff is going to work if Ukraine is going to resist the Russian advance the way they are. Or have been, and whether that's just, you know, more billions of dollars down the drain on a project that of dubious merit to begin with. I mean, it is a curious mindset of the Chinese that since their view of the world is that they are the center of the world, that it's one of those efforts. You know, that they're not in this to make friends all the time. Their worldview is so different than most countries that want to do have quality relationships with other countries. So China seems to be content to have Z be, or Xi, or however you say it, friends with Putin, if Putin can have any friends, and you know, I if I were Putin, I'd be looking at and a performance of my army, and I wrote this sort of tongue-in-cheek on my blog, but I'd be concerned about China taking a look at the assets that are available to them in the Far East if they decided to move back and get some of what used to be Chinese territory up there where a lot of oil and gas properties are in Russia and the Sakhalin Island and all that stuff. So I wouldn't rest too easy if I were Putin with a friend like China who can I think could take a look at that and go, well, let's see this ferocious Russian army come east, because based on their performance in Ukraine, they don't look too well organized right now, especially since their cheap Chinese tires keep falling off on their vehicles.
You get what you pay for. But yeah, you and I, with our various guests we've had over the course of the last decade, we've been ringing that bell for a long time. That it's not, you know, in the top one or two geographical things they want to take care of. But the Russian Far East has only been Russian since, I think, the 1840s. That used to be Chinese, and they have always considered the treaty in which they ceded that to Russia as being unjust. And that's on China's list. Russia has to know that. It's not this year, but it's on their list. And that short-term partnership with Russia and China, I guess they'll figure they'll deal with that at some point down the road. But yeah, you brought an interesting point that China doesn't have the background, the training, or the worldview that our and the European foreign policy groups do. If you want to dismissively call it, you know, the Davos mindset, are those that are used to dealing with the polite talking shops of the EU or NATO, or the exchange program between Leeds University and Harvard. They're very hard. They're very nosy. Like, what's in this for us? What good can this do us? And they may have made a lot of assumptions upon what the Russians would be able to do in Ukraine. And there's a lot of questionable information out there about what the Russians thought they were going to be able to accomplish. I've seen stuff where, you know, they planned for 15 days. We're not 15 days in yet. That's true. I think one of the sillier things is – they said, well, the Russian troops are operating so poorly because that's the old Russian-Soviet tradition that they send their worst troops up first to be chewed up and their good ones follow behind. If that's true, they wouldn't have tried to seize the airport in Kiev on day one with their airborne troops. And eventually it fell. It's in their possession now, but they were going for a decapitation strike. Which tells me they were planning on a short war. And we haven't seen, quote, better, unquote, forces that the Russians to push out here. And time isn't on their side. The longer this goes, the more danger there is for everybody, including Russia. I think they thought this would have been a lot easier, which means this is what they briefed their Chinese friends, which I'm willing to bet some money that China was pre-griefed on this, or that at least this was an option for them. So I don't know if what a variety of directions this can go. At the end of the day, China's big concern, which goes back to, you know, what we talked about at the top of the hour, is they need to keep their people happy. They need to keep their people content. They need to keep their people fed. And they need to have their economy going the way it needs to go. And the only way they can do that is by importing lots and lots of food. And Russia and Ukraine are a big part of that. This war goes on for a few more months through spring planting. There's nothing that's going to prevent Russia from planting. But with much of the breadbasket and a lot of the farmers pulling tanks around that have run out of gas as opposed to putting crops in the ground, that 20% USDA estimate for 2022, that's got to be a lot higher. And that's going to impact China's, you can call them middle class, but they're really upper lower class, where being able to feed yourself and being able to house yourself is a month-to-month activity.
Yeah, I mean, Z mentioned the grain, he thinks it's a grain shortage in his speech last Sunday. And, you know, what do we see? What do we see coming out of his, you know, they're going to raise, China's planning to raise their domestic defense spending 7%. And, you know, their numbers are skewed lower than U.S. numbers because they don't pay their troops very much. But 7% is a big jump. And they're also cutting back, you know, warning about an economic downturn, which is probably going to get worse rather than better as countries begin to disconnect from China to the extent they can. I mean, we turn China into this monster production area, but the price that we're paying for them being a monster production area is a lot higher than I think a lot of people want to pay now that they've had a chance to look at it over a 20-year period and see where China's going with this. And it'll be interesting to see how bad things get and what their new president forever is going to do about the situation he's got himself into.
And good news to everybody. We have our guest on the line. So we are going to have a guest today. You and I won't have to handle all the intellectual work. So for the listeners, we'll go ahead. I want to welcome to Midrats Dean Chang. He is the Senior Research Fellow for Chinese Political and Security Affairs at the Aegis Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation. Dean, welcome aboard to Midrats.
Thank you very much. This is very embarrassing, but I'm afraid my watch stopped. And I had not realized that the time it was. I do apologize. I'm very, very sorry about that.
No problem at all. We forget our mute buttons. I've gotten the time schedule messed up a bit. It's the type of things that keep you humble and keep the heart beating. It's no problem at all.
Yes, it certainly keeps the heart beating, not necessarily in a good way.
Well, hey, I don't know if you're able to hear the kickoff, but before we leave it, I just wanted to kind of rewind a bit for the listeners because I'd really be interested to get your take on this. Is when I was reading your recent article, one thing that kind of popped into my mind is I was remembering back in December and January that there were all these articles out about China hoarding grains and the impact that was going to have in 2022 on global food prices, where, you know, the USDA said that China was hoarding 69% of the global inventory of corn, 60% of rice, 51% of wheat. And you know, I'm not a conspiracy-minded person, but sometimes there's coordination that goes on in the world. Might be a polite way to see it. But in my mind, it almost, you know, is this an indication and warning that as opposed to what our State Department thought, where China was going to be our friend and help us make Russia behave itself, that the Chinese were given indications by the Russians that, hey, buddy, pal, you might want to get a hedge against grain prices next year because we may do something. Do you think how do you see that connection between last year's hoarding and what we're seeing right now, war in Eurasia's breadbasket?
Well, I think what is interesting is that in the middle of this war, life goes on elsewhere. And one of the places it goes on is China. And so they are having their regular meeting of the National People's Congress, which unlike our Congress is not in session all the time. It sort of shows up about once a year, rubber stamps a bunch of legislation and moves on. But in the process of doing this, they also report out what is the state of the economy, What is the defense budget going to look like? They've announced a 7.1% increase in the budget. One of the reports that came out was from the Agricultural Ministry that said that China's winter wheat crop is one of the worst in history. Now, when we put that alongside two fun things from China, one is something called fall armyworm. This is an alien invader. It is an omnivore. It eats, among other things, wheat, corn, and cotton. And we look at African swine fever, which is a pig disease that has no cure. And the only solution, if your herd gets it, is to wipe it out entirely and then basically wipe out everything around it for like 10 miles. China's got a food problem. And China has had a food problem of growing proportions over the last several years. So possible there was coordination? I think it is possible. I think also the Chinese may well have, because they have been engaging in joint military exercises with the Russians over the last several years, they may even have had informal things of, hey, that's some new kit you guys have got. What's the deal? It's like, yeah, we're trying this out. That they were looking at this and saying, there's a whole lot of straws in the wind. Plus, we have a really bad agricultural situation. We're already a net food importer. It's getting worse. Let's stock up. And then one other quick thing about this is that the 20th Party Congress is later this fall. Xi Jinping is going to be reanointed for another minimum 5 years to be head of the party as opposed to head of the state. This is going to be politically very important. It's also going to be very difficult because Xi basically is breaking all the rules that Deng Xiaoping had laid down. The last thing you want when you're doing stuff like that is, and oh, by the way, we have food shortages. We're going to have to reimpose rationing. On this glorious event of the 20th Party Congress, the last thing you want is, and one of the things we're going to do is go back to 1950s, 1960s style China food rationing. So again, you want to make sure you have enough grain. You want to make sure you have enough producers, whether it's cooking oil, soy sauce, or pig feed for your new herds. So you're going to stock up.
I hope I didn't put everyone
to sleep.
No. One of the things that I discussed before you joined us was that when I first saw what they were doing to the grains, I was thinking of anticipation of a blockade should they go after Taiwan in the near future. Because I think they have a year and a half. I read the other day that they had a year and a half worth of grains stocked up already. Any thoughts on a potential blockade storage issue with them?
Well, this is where the coordination issue with the Russians would become much more problematic, because I think that if the Chinese were to invade Taiwan, they would have expected the Russians and possibly the Ukrainians pre-war to be a major source of food, particularly of grains. Interestingly, back in the 1990s, the Chinese signed massive leases with the Ukrainians for farmland, basically to buy whatever they were going to grow out there. So one of the interesting things about the whole China-Ukraine-Russia situation is the extent to which the Russians have taken over Ukrainian farmland that possibly the Chinese had already leased. Would the Chinese be worried about a blockade? As the Chinese are very good students of history, they have seen how, one, the West automatically imposes blockades, and two, how devastating those blockades can be, whether it was the Allies against Germany in World War I, or the Allies, mainly the Americans, against the Japanese in World War II. So it wouldn't surprise me if this was a consideration if they were thinking of invading Taiwan. But I think it's something that they would think about doing even if they weren't going to invade Taiwan, because being a net food importer, that means that always aware that some of the largest producers of grain in the world are the United States, Australia, and Canada. Allies, countries that the Chinese have ticked off, particularly the Australians, and the food has to come from far away by sea, which for the moment at least, the U.S. still dominates the world's oceans. So even if you went to other places, Brazil, Argentina, for grain, for beef, that still has to make it over there. So I think if you're the Chinese, just as an insurance policy, you're going to want to have stockpiles of grain, especially as relations with the United States deteriorate. A Taiwan situation obviously would make things worse. But with everything we're seeing out of Ukraine, I do suspect that the Chinese are re-looking a lot of their war plans and a lot of their thoughts. Popular resistance, how easy is it to destroy the will of an adversary? How hard is it? Is modern warfare, remembering they haven't fought a war since 79. So I'm a little less concerned about the prospect of a near-term invasion of Taiwan.
Yeah, I'll agree with you there, Dean. I think the a lot of times in peace or when there's been a large separation since a major conflict, that the theorists and the people who make their living doing happy talk briefs can get a lot of leeway because they don't have any real world examples. And, you know, so far the conflict is pretty short, but I would think, you know, China, having not had her own personal experience recently in conflict, I think one of the things they have got to be contemplating about is the logistics challenge about getting across the Taiwan Strait and being able to stay and sustain that if they develop greater resistance than they would expect to see. And I think that, if anything, because there have been some people who have been talking about whether it's the Davidson window or this, that, or the other thing, that the window was near for China. And if China is fairly risk adverse, and one thing I mentioned before you joined us is, you know, China has a very long history of the, lack of a better phrase, the social disruption due to famine and high food prices, that if you look at the risk-reward for engaging in that, if there would be a byproduct, I think the lessons that are coming out of the Ukraine war so far, and the inflation that the whole globe is going to see, especially in food, that's going to impact their risk analysis on when is a good time, and perhaps that can give us a little bit of a window. I don't know if that's too optimistic or if that's one way to look at it.
No, I think that that's true. Now, one of the funny things, though, is that there are other things that might sort of make us more pessimistic. And my boss at work says that I'm the most depressing person he's ever had to work with. So I automatically trend pessimistic. One of the things that's fascinating in China is Singles Day, which, if I remember right, is November 11th, 1111. This is the biggest single retail event in human act. Literally, billions of dollars are bought, of merchandise is bought on that day. Gifts for friends, gifts for parents, gifts for children, gifts for yourself. Everybody has sales. This is Christmas, Valentine's Day, Halloween, your birthday rolled up in one. And everything gets delivered within about 2 weeks. Now, to give you a sense, what that means is that you have 1.3 billion Chinese minus some number of small children who basically are going to order random amounts of stuff from random suppliers who are then going to have to ship it across all of China down to some little village somewhere. And everyone expects to get their stuff within 2 weeks. And the Chinese have been doing this for years. So my fear is that the lessons learned from something like that are being put to use. Everything from RFID tags and tracking of containers down to who needs what at literally on each city block, each apartment. If you're the PLA, this is a goldmine opportunity to try out package tracking, on-time delivery, use of drones, use of mopeds, everything else. Now, that doesn't get you across the ocean, but it gets you at least to the port. And with the world's largest shipping fleet, you've got a lot of merchant ships available to do a lot of things. And again, I think that the Chinese are using their global shipping experience, port management experience, to streamline and improve their logistics capacity to support a Taiwan contingent.
Well, the other question I have, this is logistics too, is they've got this Belt and Road Initiative going, and Ukraine was providing about 30%, I think, of the Russian, the Chinese corn imports. And apparently the Poles, the Ukrainians, and a bunch of other people in Europe now are pretty miffed at China, because China does not, being friends with Russia, does not admit that what happened was a Russian invasion of Ukraine, and that Russia is in the wrong. And so a lot of that, there's some contention, I think I read a Reuters article recently, contention that Putin has completely screwed up this Belt and Road Initiative the Chinese had going to get goods and stuff to and from Europe. Any views on that?
So the Belt and Road Initiative, one of the interesting things when you look at Chinese maps of Belt and Road is that all the investments, all of the pipelines and railways and all the other stuff head west and then southwest. So they go to Kazakhstan, they go to Turkmenistan, they go to Uzbekistan, and then they all head southwest towards the Caucasus and Iran and Turkey and then back out into Europe. So the Russians don't seem to have been a major locus of BRI investment, and I would suggest that that's probably working on both sides. I think the Russians don't want to depend on the Chinese if they can help it, although this war is going to change all that. And the Chinese didn't particularly want to help the Russians because, well, they have a long history of not liking each other as well. So these are two countries who are happy to work together when it comes to countering the United States, but not necessarily in terms of helping each other. So the Chinese, on the one hand, have politically made very clear that, there's this fascinating example where the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokeswoman basically lectured Western journalists for calling it an invasion. That's a Western term. But at the same time, we see that there are some cracks. The Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, heavily backed by the Chinese, has suspended loans to Russia and Belarus. Some Chinese banks are looking at the situation and saying, we're not willing to extend letters of additional credit to Russian energy, to Russian companies. So there's a bit of a mixed bag there. Now, the flip side to that is China signed deals to buy 100 million tons of Russian coal, has lifted wheat export import restrictions, so they're able to import from Russia. They obviously diplomatically pretty much line up with the Russians. The interesting question is going to be, as the war continues, especially as Russia takes chunks of southern Ukraine, where there are key industrial complexes that supply China, and if they are taking over land that was leased to China, are the Chinese basically going to look at this and say, well, Russia's definitely got all the stuff we care about in Ukraine, so we're going to be even more supportive? Because there's nothing much indicating why China would be less supportive of Russia at this phase of the conflict. But it is important for your listeners to also understand, these two countries at this point aren't allies. It's not like there's any prospect of Chinese military forces helping the Russians to plow their way into Ukraine. The biggest thing the Chinese probably have done has been to signal Moscow that it was safe for them to transfer military forces from the east to the west. That, I have to admit, when I heard that, it was two things. One, the Russians are coming. And two, man, there's a lot more coordination going on between these two countries if Moscow feels confident enough to actually pull forces from the east. That is a huge political statement. It may even be decisive. Let's remember that the defense of Moscow in 1941 was conducted by the Siberians, who were released from the east because the Soviets realized the Japanese were not going to invade North.
Yeah, that caught my attention, too, when you had the just train car after train car after train car and their SU-25 divisions coming from the Far East over. They just left the door open and had an incredible level of trust with the Chinese. And I think that signaled to the Chinese, if you want to build a relationship, you show trust with people. I agree with you. When that was happening, it was like, this isn't just a simple little exercise. They're it takes a lot of money to move that much across a continent, much less the vulnerabilities that come with it. I wanted to ask you something because you mentioned for a bit about the Chinese banks, and there's been some real interesting writing over the course of the last week helping people understand the Russian oligarchs and their relationship and their reliance on Putin and Putin's political structures, that there's a mistake to be made trying to equate what motivates and intimidates and gets the attention of a Western billionaire is mostly different than the same set of incentives and disincentives that a Russian oligarch will look at. And, of course, a lot of the news of the last, really since the Hong Kong uprisings, has been the Chinese Communist Party kind of putting the screws on some of the Chinese billionaire. I think the classic example was Jack Ma. He disappeared and came back a different person. And do you see a similar type of dynamic with the Chinese billionaires and their relationship with Xi and the Russian oligarchs? Codependency with Putin and his political leaders, and if so, would that impact that economic connection between the two?
I think that the Russian oligarchs are dependent on Putin to a very different way than the Chinese businessmen are on Xi, and to the government structure in general. I think Russia, let me be upfront here. I'm not a Russia expert. So what you're about to hear is the totally unqualified musings of somebody who spends their time looking at China, not Russia. But my impression is that the Russian oligarchs are something of a kleptocratic class. The heads of lots of Russian corporations have made huge fortunes strip mining Russia. And some have done so with the open help of Putin. Some have simply taken advantage of the situation in Russia's overall government. That there are different oligarchs. The ones who run the defense industrial complex probably are actually moderately happy with what's going on. They'll have lots of contracts. People who run other things in Russia may not be so happy. In China, there was this period in the 90s and 2000s when people thought that the new rising class of wealthy people in China were really going to become a rival power center to the Chinese Communist Party. The Chinese Communist Party had become almost like an old-fashioned men's club, gentlemen's club kind of thing. I don't mean a strip club. I mean like, you know, sort of a fancy eating establishment where people sit down and make contracts and cut deals and behind closed doors. I'm not sure that was ever true, but what is very clear is that Xi Jinping has turned that upside down. You business people exist at the basically at the will and sufferance of the party. And we, the party, will break you if we feel it necessary or if we feel you are challenging us. Jack Ma is the best example, mostly because he's the most well-known. But if you take a look at the head of Wanda Dalian, Anbang Corporation, Fusheng Bank, all of these wealthy Chinese who, in some cases, simply saw the light and decided to break up their own companies. And in other cases, like the head of HNA, weirdly enough, goes to France, visits a chateau, and then just steps off the side of a several hundred-foot cliff. No obvious reason at all. But, I mean, the point here is that in China, the businessmen have been told in pretty much no uncertain terms, especially with Jack Ma, you may be a member of the party. You are outside the system of actual power. And we will break you if we even think that you pose a challenge. What did Jack Ma do? He said Chinese financial regulation needs to be brought into the 20th century. He wasn't saying that, you know, and I need to have more power. I want a slot on the Politburo. Listen to me where I'm going to have riots and protests in 50 cities. He's talking about fairly technical and actually at the end of the day, fairly reasonable updates in how the Chinese financial regulators operated. She saw that as a challenge and promptly ended one of the largest IPOs, $37 billion, within 4 or 5 days of it going public. I mean, that's a huge loss of money, probably even to some of Xi's advisors. But it was worth it to break one of the wealthiest, but also one of the most popular people in China. So I think it's a very different relationship between Chinese businessmen, this uber wealthy, and the state and the party and Russian oligarchs with Putin.
I'm still hung up, Dean, on thinking about the Russians emptying, I'm not sure if they've emptied it yet, their military from the eastern part of Russia. And thinking about the Chinese sitting there looking at how weak the Russians have been so far, and you know, if the claim is that Taiwan ought to be reclaimed and Hong Kong and all that, what about all that territory that the Russians got? Sakhalin Island, Vladivostok, all that good stuff. Any thoughts that the Chinese might say, you know, this might be a good time to reclaim some of that territory we gave up under duress back in our century of humiliation or before?
The first thing to keep in mind is that, at least officially, Deng Xiaoping and Mikhail Gorbachev signed a number of agreements that said, okay, here are where the borders are going to be, and we have resolved our outstanding territorial problems. Now, the focus of the 1969 Sino-Soviet border war, people forget that the Chinese and the Soviets actually did fight a war. It was a real war. It wasn't just a couple of, you know, casualties. It was hundreds, if not thousands, was over Dzhambao Island, also known as Damansky Island, on the, I believe it's the Amur River. The Amur and Ussuri rivers out in the far Russian Far East, up near Manchuria. And the whole fight there was the island itself, Chinese territory, Russian territory, and where was the separation between the two sides? Was it the middle of the river, the Chinese shore of the river, et cetera? And they fought a war over this. It got very heated. It later extended to what is now Kazakhstan. Remember, back then it was part of the Soviet Union. And Xinjiang, sound familiar? There were border battles there as well. And in the late 80s, early 90s, Gorbachev and Deng signed essentially a peace treaty, a territorial agreement that said, okay, this is where the border is going to be. We both accept this. And the successor states, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, et cetera, have basically inherited that. And so for the moment, at least, the Chinese say we are okay with where the borders are. The other thing to keep in mind is Russia has lots of nukes. So that is something that Taiwan doesn't have. Hong Kong obviously didn't have. Nobody in the South China Sea has. So any prospect of reclaiming traditional territory becomes much more problematic, given that Russia is most likely willing to fire nukes in its own defense, where you could have some very, very, very scary, ugly issues. Might be Outer Mongolia. Outer Mongolia was only established in 1921. Was established with the help of the newly born Soviet Union against the still weak Republic of China under Chiang Kai-shek. In fact, I'm not even sure Chiang was fully in charge at that point yet. So to old line Chinese, and notice I say Chinese, not Chinese communists, not only is Taiwan obviously part of China and the South China Sea part of China and the Senkaku is part of China, but Outer Mongolia was torn away from China. Do I think the Chinese are going to roll tank divisions into Outer Mongolia? No. Do I think that this might be a perfect opportunity for them to increase subversion and influence and try to foment unhappiness in Ulaanbaatar in order to affect Outer Mongolia? Yeah, I wouldn't put it past them. Again, in part because the world is right now focused on another part of the world. What I will say also is that I would keep a very close eye on the South China Sea. The Chinese are currently doing a bunch of new military exercises down there. And there are a number of claimants who don't have allies, Vietnam and Malaysia especially come to mind, where the Chinese may well want to do what I term a Grenada option, fight a very small war that they really can't lose. At the end of the day, you're just bigger than your adversaries, especially in that one locality. And you could take territory simply by swamping the enemy. But with countries that don't have allies, it's going to be really hard to stop them. In the case of the Philippines, they are allied with the United States. Whether we're committed to their defense of the Spratlys is a separate issue. But, you know, here, and you get a chance to try out your new equipment, your new doctrine, your new command structure, your new organization, your new logistics structures. China has all of those things that has never fought a war with any of them. You might want to try it out before you go for the, you know, big league game of trying to take Taiwan.
Kind of like the, what was the phrase from the Spanish-American War, a splendid little war. And it's interesting you talked about nations that don't have allies. I think that's one of the larger takeaways for those types of nations is they need to listen less to certain internationalist bodies and maybe talk a little bit more to the Swiss, that you really do need to be armed to the teeth because nations throughout the world can have lights shine their buildings in your country's flag, but if you don't have anybody fighting for you, it can be very tough to face up to some of these big players. And one of the things, and I'm a natural skeptic towards the UN, but the UN's important, and there can be some good things that could be done through the UN. But that takes all the nations working together. And, you know, when you look at the major players in the UN Security Council, you have, you know, the U.S., France, and U.K. They're in NATO, long-term relationships there, of course. And then you have China and Russia. How have we seen that relationship build? And do you see what direction do you see in 2022 that they might be able to either pursue their interests or create mischief in the UN if they have some shared goals there?
Well, first off, when you have one veto, you pretty much stymie the Security Council. And when you have two vetoes, you really stymie the Security Council. What is fascinating about the Chinese is that since the PRC took the UN seat, the Security Council seat, and I believe it was 1971, they've only used their veto about 17 times. And almost all of them, up until a couple of years ago, had to do somehow with Taiwan. So, for example, they opposed the admission of the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia because Fyrom, the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, recognized Taiwan. Oh, no, you don't. We're not going to let you in. There were a couple of other cases about peacekeepers in places that, again, had some vague tie to Taiwan. Beginning in the late 20-teens, the Chinese started casting vetoes in support of Syria. This happened after both China and Russia acquiesced to a no-fly zone over Libya that eventually led to the beheading of Muammar Gaddafi. And it's very clear that both Moscow and Beijing saw this as a giant betrayal. You, the West, got us to go along with a no-fly zone that was ostensibly for humanitarian purposes that ultimately led to regime change. We are not going to fall for that again. And so the Chinese have vetoed 10 times on Syria, often in cases where the Russians had already cast a veto on behalf of Syria. So what you see is Chinese signaling in conjunction with Moscow, regime change is not acceptable. We don't buy this whole humanitarian no-fly zone thing anymore. We don't buy this humanitarian intervention anymore. When Samantha Power was all about R2P, responsibility to protect, it was clear that had no traction with Beijing. And at the same time, you see the Russians and the Chinese cooperate in places like Geneva and elsewhere over space arms control and the like. So I think what we are going to see is a continuation of this. I think that, you know, no one is going to be able to boot the Russians out of the UN. The charter just doesn't allow that. The General Assembly, I think, recently passed a resolution condemning Moscow. 141 nations went along with that. What is also useful to note in all this is it's not just the Chinese. India abstained on the measures to condemn Russia. Why? In part because Russia is the largest arms supplier to India. Vital systems, surface-to-air missiles, advanced fighter aircraft, etc. And, of course, India is opposing China. So this all gets extraordinarily complex. But the thing here is that the UN is going to be the site where we're going to have lots more speeches, lots more condemnatory actions, lots of vetoes. Probably not too much in the way of meaningful advances or changes.
Well, as you're looking at your magic eight ball into the future of this mess that's going on right now, where do you see? I mean, is China going to try to be this peacemaker in Ukraine? Is that just for show? What can China do to support Putin if they're going to do anything to other than say it's okay to move your troops from the east to the front? Where's China? What's China's end game in this?
I think China's overall end game is fairly straightforward. For at the end of the day, when the dust settles, China to be in a better off position than it is right now. And that means, relatively speaking, against the West, especially the United States, specifically against Russia, against India, against Japan. And that's not just militarily, although that's some of it, but also economically and globally. So just a couple of quick things to think about here. At the end of this war, even if Putin wins, he will have ground some of his best forces to nubs. So there is not going to be much of a Russian conventional threat to China for some time to come, because he's going to have to recapitalize and rebuild his military. And where's the money going to come from for that? He's going to have a very hostile West, which means he's going to presumably prioritize allocating forces westward. Unfortunately, that also means he's probably going to rely a lot more on nuclear weapons as a deterrent. So that's a mixed bag for the Chinese. The Chinese, here's an interesting factoid. Visa, MasterCard, PayPal have killed operations in Russia. So they are not able, you know, if you're an average Russian, you cannot use your Visa or MasterCard. But several of the Russian banks have already established ties to Alipay and to, I believe it's called UnionPay, which are Chinese credit card systems. And they have come online, and you can now use those. China created something called the China Interbank Payment System. It's their attempt at SWIFT. SWIFT, the Global International Financial Transaction Network, has 11,000 banks. CIPS has 1,100 banks. There's a Russian version of this that has like 400 banks. Both the Russian and Chinese systems are largely Russian and Chinese, respectively. You're almost certainly going to see those link up. I would predict that in the coming 5 years, the highest priority for the Chinese is going to be creating a global international financial transaction network that will remove the dependence on SWIFT. The Chinese are watching what has happened with SWIFT and said, dang, we got to get our own international system set up so that if and when Taiwan becomes the issue, or even just if U.S.-China relations deteriorate, we will be able to operate without the United States. Then you've set a lot of groundwork in place. And in terms of when might the Chinese take Taiwan, I do think it's important to recognize what the Chinese themselves say. Their focus is being a fully modernized military by 2027. being what they term fully mechanized, fully informationized, and fully intelligenceized. That means artificial intelligence, smarter systems, et cetera, across a PLA. Think of a PLA with an Internet of Things aspect. That's their target date. So I would say that after 2027, we should all definitely be nervous. Before then, I just don't think that Beijing is going to basically start a war simply because there's a quote-unquote window of opportunity. There's a huge amount of risk. Losing will really hurt the CCP, raise questions about its survival. And they have their own timetable. And while we don't know what it is, it doesn't seem to be very easily swayed by, hey, here's an opportunity just to grab something off the table right now.
Yeah, I agree with you that we can't underestimate the Chinese patience, especially when their major global competitors keep getting themselves distracted in wars someplace. They can continue to modernize and invest and look forward. And in that time frame, because things move pretty fast, I found one of the interesting developments over the course of the last week has been in space in two things. One, you know, after the Cold War, you know, we found the ability to partner with the Russians and do space stuff on the cheap, enabled us to decouple from the space shuttle, et cetera, and so forth. And the Russians have been instrumental in the International Space Station going forward. And there have been some rumblings about future Russian support for that. Brought a rather cute reply from Elon Musk and SpaceX. And also, SpaceX has been instrumental in keeping the internet connection via Starlink to Ukraine, kind of going around Russia in that regards. And when you look at a lot of the innovation in space, it's the private sector in the United States and in a few places in the European Union as well. And with the friction that we've found with the Russians recently, do you see the Russians wanting to partner and the Chinese wanting to partner more with the Russians in space and all the second and third order effects that can derive from that?
Well, the Chinese and the Russians are both interested in space. Space is seen as a key battlefield for both of them in any future conflict. But I'm not sure we have seen much evidence of actual cooperation. They haven't really done much in the way of joint space exploration missions. The Chinese have bought a bunch of Russian space technology, but a lot of that was when you had a fire sale going on. What I think that you are far more likely to see in the future, however, is cooperation simply to signal the West, we are not dependent on you. There has been talk about, for example, a joint Russian-Chinese lunar facility of some kind, probably orbiting the moon. Where I do think what is fascinating is I think both countries also do look at Elon Musk as being one of the greatest threats to both of them. When it comes to, for example, Russian space launch, commercial space launch, SpaceX eats their lunch. The Chinese have been effectively kept out of the commercial space launch business thanks to U.S. arms export controls. So again, they are looking at Elon Musk as being an innovator who poses an enormous challenge to them. Where I think that you're also seeing, specifically in Ukraine, is already Musk is reporting that there is jamming going on with Starlink satellites, probably by the Russians. And that suggests use of military space operations that we've theorized, but is now occurring in real time in war. NASIC, National Air and Space Intelligence Center, has issued reports regarding counter space capabilities that would include jamming. And now we're seeing some of that coming to fruition. The funny thing about Musk is in some ways he's almost like the positive version of a Bond supervillain. He is a wealthy multi-gajillionaire who has his own technology base and is able to make choices and decisions that arguably rival that of nation states. And, you know, Ernst Stavro Blofeld is a bad guy. In his case, he seems much more like a good guy, doing things that, you know, in the past might have been much more the purview of governments.
Yeah, I just read an interesting Stephen Pressfield novel about how that situation with some of these very wealthy people being able to hire their own armies and stuff may cause issues in the future. We've taken up, and we're coming to the end of the show. I wanted to give you a chance to talk about what's on your plate right now, what our listeners can look forward to seeing from you, and anything else you'd like to throw out right now.
Well, first off, I very much appreciate your patience. My apologies again for relying on a watch that would stop. With regards to impending works and things, I'm personally working actually on a broader paper looking at China-Russia relations, and was also recently able to give some testimony, folks might be interested in, to the U.S.-China Economic and Security Commission regarding Chinese cyber activities and cyber warfare, looking at it from a Chinese doctrinal perspective. So again, sort of what do the Chinese say they are thinking about with regards to cyber network warfare and the like. And I do want to thank you folks again for the opportunity to be here today.
Well, Dean, it was a pleasure having you, and we're glad you were able to call back in. And I look forward to having the next time to talk to you, because this topic isn't going anywhere.
No, when you do China, you're definitely never bored.
It's gainful employment. But hope you have a great 2022, Dean.
Thank you. Yep. And same to you.
Come back and see us, Dean, sometime soon, and thank you for appearing today.
Absolutely.
And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time, I hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Yeah.